From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Congress debates the payroll tax, a dollar rescue for Europe, Newt tops the polls, Hillary to Burma, and wild winds in the West. In Scranton, Pennsylvania, President Obama warned against letting go of the payroll tax break.
It would be tough for you. It would also be a massive blow for the economy because we're not fully out of the recession yet. Don't take my word for it. This is what every independent economist says. We can't let this tax cut lapse right now.
Atlanta businesswoman Ginger White says she had a 13-year affair with GOP presidential would-be Herman Cain.
It wasn't a love affair. It was a sexual affair. As hard as that is for me to say and as hard as it is for people to hear it, you know, it pretty much is what it is.
And stock markets soared all over Wednesday as central banks moved dollars to help the euro. Here's CNBC's Brian Schachman.
Today, the Dow gaining almost 500 points, went positive for the month, and now above 12,000. In fact, although volume wasn't huge, it was the seventh largest point gain in history.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, John Bussey of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Is Cain toast? Is Newt the man? Can Ben Bernanke save Europe? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a great panel with us today. From Washington, we're joined by Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. She's been in the middle of the payroll tax debate and out on the stump with Newt Gingrich this week. Nancy, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom.
From New York, John Bussey is with us, assistant managing editor, executive business editor of the Wall Street Journal, in a week when Wall Street soared. John, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty is here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and John.
John, let me come first to you on these unemployment numbers. We haven't heard one that started with an 8 in a long time, 8.6%. The numbers just out today say that rate has not been that low since March 2009. That is a long, long time. On the other hand, we hear a big chunk of what's going on here is that the participation rate is dropping. People are just dropping out on the job market, giving up. So do we celebrate or something else, John?
Yeah, it's good news and bad news, isn't it? I mean, it is definitely good news that we are adding jobs to payrolls. No question about it. It shows some life in the economy. The unemployment rate went down, as you're pointing out, in part because people are giving up. They're leaving the workforce and they're just not looking for jobs. This is a positive, but at the end of the day, this economy needs much larger job growth to get us out of the problems that we're in now. We need to be at a substantially higher level to actually be able to count on economic growth in the coming months.
Even to get back to where we were, people are talking about much higher than this, even to get back there in 5 years. And that's quite different than dropping out. On the other hand, it's a kind of psychological relief, Nancy Cordes, to hear 8-point-something% instead of that interminable 9-point-something%. The payroll tax debate on Capitol Hill this week, all about the economy and jobs, at least from the Democrats' perspective. Where does that stand right now, Nancy?
Well, it's really in murky territory right now. You had a plan put forward by the Democrats in the Senate that failed, a plan put forward by the Republicans that failed, and that's because they weren't able to get any votes from the other side. Basically, most members of both parties want to extend these payroll tax cuts another year. In fact, Democrats want to drop them from 4% down to 3%. Where the argument is over how to pay for them. And that may not sound like a big deal, but if you remember back at the supercommittee, that's what killed the deal there. Everybody wanted to lower the deficit, but when push comes to shove and you have to figure out how to do it, that's the problem. Democrats want to pay for it with a 3% surtax on anyone making over $1 million. Republicans want to do it by freezing federal workers' pay, by reducing the size of the federal workforce by 200,000 people, a few other measures as well. And so they're very far apart at this point, and they only have a few weeks to figure this out.
It comes right back to jobs, at least in the view of many economists, saying that it might take a full point off of economic growth, GDP growth.
Yes.
That is a lot. That would be a lot of jobs not there. Let's hear a little bit of the back and forth from this week. This was Wednesday on the floor of the Senate. Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying that Republicans had come around to agreeing that the payroll tax cut break should be extended, but differed with Democrats on how to pay for it.
The debate we're having this week is not about whether to extend this temporary relief for millions of working Americans out there who are struggling as a result of the ongoing jobs crisis. It's about whether we should help those who are struggling in a bad economy by punishing the private sector businesses that the American people are counting on to help turn this economy around.
Punishing the businesses, he says, I guess the leap there is if you raise the taxes a little bit on more than millionaires, those are probably business people. I guess that's the circuit he's making. Democrats having none of it. They're saying, look, we want to keep this break. People need that cash in their pockets, and they want to extend it to go to work for businesses as well. Here's Pennsylvania Democratic Senator Bob Casey talking with MSNBC's Martin Bashir on Tuesday night.
Cutting the payroll tax in half for workers, as well as in addition to what we did last year, a payroll tax cut for businesses. So this is very good for the worker as well as his or her employer. And this is exactly the kind of strategy that we need in place to jumpstart, to kickstart the economy so we can create jobs. For the life of me, I can't understand why any Republican would want to support it.
Jack Beatty, what do you smell coming here? A stalemate? Can't figure out how to pay for it, so nothing happens and the tax break goes away? Or maybe John Boehner's been making noises saying we can work on this. Do you see room here to make something happen, Jack?
Well, there are ambiguous signals. Susan Collins, the main Republican, voted with the Democrats to continue the tax cut. Senator Joe Hans, Republican senator from Nebraska, has said that he's open to extending it and paying for it, perhaps with a tax increase on millionaires. So you get that kind of thing. You get the statement from Mr. Boehner. On the other hand, Grover Norquist has been meeting with House Republicans, and yesterday the National Journal reported.
So what's new? What's new with that?
Yeah, and
is there no tax never?
Well, yeah, except not in this case. He assured Republicans that a failure to extend the payroll tax cut should not be viewed as raising taxes. This according to the National Journal. So apparently, if a tax cut helps Mr. Obama, it's not a tax cut for Grover Norquist. So who knows where this is going to come out? It passes belief that Republicans would, and Eric Cantor has said this, our brand is we cut taxes. And in the final analysis, you have to think that somehow they're going to reach it. The Republicans have every incentive to reach some kind of deal to preserve that brand.
Nancy Cordes, give us your read on the heart of hearts here. Do Democrats want to pass this, or do they want to take this into 2012 saying, we tried to get a tax break for the middle class and Republicans would not put a little tiny, touch on millionaires?
Both. And I think Republicans know that. And Republicans are really in a tough spot on this one. It's not often that they are on the losing end of a tax cut fight, but they're really in a corner here because, for one thing, they're arguing that a tax cut needs to be paid for. That's something that they haven't done before. And they're sort of looking at each other now going, wait, what are we doing? We don't want to set a precedent of arguing that a tax cut should be paid for. Also,
because
the Republican
Party is...
Because we know
tax cuts pay for themselves,
exactly.
Nancy.
Exactly. And so, there's a fight between Republicans over whether this should be extended at all. Then Democrats have a very easy argument to make to say, okay, wait, you don't want to lower taxes on 160 million people because you have a problem increasing a tax on 360,000 really wealthy people. So that's why Republicans know that they're in a very tough spot. That's why you saw Susan Collins going over to the Democratic side. That's why you heard what you heard from Johans. Republicans do not want this fight to linger because they know that, it's not a winning battle for them.
On the other hand, stalling growth could work for them in 2012 with a sitting president right there. John Bussey, look across the Atlantic with us for a second. Ben Bernanke and other central bank leaders, but Ben Bernanke very importantly this week, kind of riding to the rescue, at least for a minute for Europe, with a whole lot of dollars being pushed Europe's way. Why did the central banks and Ben Bernanke act on that this week, John?
Yeah, there's a good news story and a bad news story here. What really happened with the central banks was a technical move. They just made it cheaper to borrow dollars. They are worried that European banks are in such trouble that they're having trouble getting dollars from their corollary banks from around the world. People don't want to lend to them. And as a result, they can't do normal things that banks do, like finance trade and act as intermediaries, and that could hurt the global economy. So what did the Fed do? The Fed joined with a bunch of other central banks and said, okay, we're going to make it much cheaper for you to borrow dollars. That's a technical thing. It was meant to make sure that the system stays liquefied. Now, the markets way reacted to that, and I think in part because they felt – you know something, maybe there's parental supervision out there someplace after all. And even though this was kind of a narrow bore thing that was happening, the central banks look to be backstopping the global economy. The bad news side of this, the negative read on this is that, my gosh, central banks had to step in, make dollar borrowing cheaper because the banks are in such trouble.
And the word out there that maybe some really teetering this week, Lehman Brothers style, and still we could go over the cliff. Here, this was Wednesday on All Things Considered. Reuters finance guru Felix Salmon talking about where the European euro crisis stands.
This is doing nothing to solve the debt crisis. This is not about the debt crisis. This is about the liquidity crisis, which is a different crisis. So we've managed to solve one crisis, but the other big crisis is still there.
Jack, we got a little ego buzz. It's been a long time for the moment, though, with the dollar coming to the rescue. It at least felt like it had Uncle Sam, you know, doing something consequential here, if only for a minute.
Yeah, somebody quipped that it was the case of the, you know, the last horse standing in the glue factory who came to the rescue.
That would be us. Hi-oh, silver. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a big week in the news, payroll tax debate, dollars for Europe, Herman Cain in trouble, Gingrich soaring. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News. John Bussey is here, assistant managing editor at The Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. We'll go right to that Cain story, but people are really thinking about jobs. Mike in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I kind of had a little thing about the Cain issue, too. But, a lot of the frustration, I think, with me and a lot of people in the country is, especially people that are struggling with employment, is you've got a group of people here. You know, they're assigning committees to do this and do this task and do that task. If it was anybody else in any other position in any other job in this country with multitasking today, with wages not increasing, these are people that are privy to special, being able to do business with special interest groups and being...
You're talking about Congress people, Mike.
Yes. As far as investing in the stock market, there's different rules for them as far as investing money. They can, as far as insider trading, they can almost practice that.
Yeah, there's that sense and that fact that they've kind of drifted away from the people out there in the millions looking for jobs. We'll look at that. And what about Herman Cain, Mike? What do you make of his predicament?
You know, kind of compare it to in school when, remember, you would have to, everybody would have to read out loud from a textbook. And, you know, you kind of felt sorry for the guy that couldn't read, and, you know, he was struggling with reading out loud, wasn't very good at it. You know, you feel sorry for that guy, but the guy that was raising his hand going, me, I want to read, and then they couldn't even read a sentence out loud.
Hey, you know, I think he can read just fine, but he may get read the riot act in Atlanta today by his wife. We'll find out soon enough on this Ginger White front. But, Mike, thank you. Caleb in Boston. Caleb, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Big fan of Jack Beatty. Thanks for being
all
on.
All right.
Wanted to comment on the statistics that are often cited. I'm glad you guys are focusing on workforce participation because it's not talked about enough. I think that's the most important statistic, and as we see, it's lower than 82 levels. So we're at a very, very desperate place. Now, what's not talked about in that regard, however, is composition of the labor force and composition of the jobs that are created, salary levels of those jobs. So, for instance, if we're talking about a 20 to 30,000 job numbers cut from public sector, and then the aggregate dollar benefit of those jobs is relatively high if you're including pensions and and all the rest, and then you're replacing these with maybe twice as many minimum wage or even temporary or contract work jobs, this is not necessarily a positive thing. So jobs is a uninsightful and not necessarily contributive mantra.
Caleb, we've got it. You like Jack, I'll put that to him. I mean, Jack, there's a clear-eyed vision of this. We've seen when you take all the workers who've kind of given up or are discouraged, unemployment can be way up in the teens, even higher. And Caleb presents a picture of an American workforce kind of beaten down, you know, driven out of the public workforce and then just going for whatever wage they can get. I mean, there's a lot to unpack in these numbers.
I think he raises an excellent point. And Robert Reich, I think, put it in stark relief this week, pointing out that payrolls, wages as a percentage of the economy are now lower than they were percentage-wise since 1929, whereas corporate profits are highest since 1929. I mean, that's shocking. And I think that's to say that aggregately, even if jobs are created, the wage total is not going up, or it's not going up nearly as much as corporate profits. And meanwhile, the corporations sit on those trillions and not enough demand for them, apparently, in the economy to have them reinvest.
We just got to get this engine going. Speaking of shocking, all week long, or maybe not shocking, I don't know at this point exactly, but all week long, we saw the face on TV all over the place of Ms. Ginger White of Atlanta saying that she'd had a 13-year affair with Herman Cain. You heard it at the top of the hour. It was not a love affair. It was a sexual affair. Wow, put it right out there. Herman Cain saying he's headed home to Atlanta today to talk with his wife about this, to think about what to do about his campaign. On Wednesday night, he told reporters in Ohio that he talked with her on the phone about the allegations. He'll meet face-to-face with her today and decide what to do.
I do not make decisions based upon a knee-jerk reaction. There were several things that we are evaluating. I'm evaluating the impact of all of this on my family first. My wife and my family is important to me like it is to anybody.
How is your wife?
She's doing great, number one. And so since I've been campaigning all week, I haven't had an opportunity to sit down with her and walk through this with my wife and my family. I will do that when I get back home on Friday.
How is your wife? She's doing great. I wonder, Nancy Cordes, what do you make of this, the Herman Cain situation here? All week long he's been saying this is a conspiracy being mounted against me. Yes, I knew her. Yes, I gave her money, but it was from my kind, soft heart. There's Ginger
but
White.
But I didn't tell my wife about it.
Well, you know, come on, I'm a busy guy. What about Herman Cain and his presidential nomination prospects at this point?
Well, I think he does have a big problem in Atlanta facing him, but he has a big problem elsewhere as well. And you started to see political reporters this week who are traveling with him write his political obituary, saying not just that this latest allegation is a problem or that the sexual harassment allegations are a problem, but that his campaign is basically defunct at this point, incompetent. And that's the kind of thing I have rarely seen come from political writers. People never want to be the one to sound the death knell. Usually that's something that comes from the candidate. But apparently people who have been traveling with him as he cancels appearances, as, you know, he says one thing, but his staffers say a different thing, or staffers say we're not going to address that. And then he does address it, but then they contradict each other. They're starting to say this doesn't appear to be a true functioning campaign any longer.
John Bussey, how do you see Herman Cain? I mean, he came up like gangbusters. His very frank talk and kind of charismatic appeal really spoke to a lot of Americans. What do you make of the conspiracy charge, John? Does that ring true to you, or does it just sound like a desperate guy looking for something?
Well, I think it's a tiny bit on the latter. I mean, we've seen one candidate after another soar to the top of the heap in the Republican primaries. And I think at root what this shows is a GOP very unsure about who it wants to put forward against Obama. That's kind of the core issue here. In the case of Herman Cain, he's got major problems at this point. You're right, Nancy, the obituaries are starting to be written. But this also gets back to what one of your earlier callers kind of raised about congressional management and management of the country. Our election process is so drawn out, and these iterations of crisis and of scandal so dominate the airwaves and bandwidth, intellectual bandwidth in this country, that we don't get other stuff done.
That may be. On the other hand, Jack, in some ways I'm glad it's drawn out. I mean, it has been a kind of circus, but it gives us a chance to get to know people who are otherwise rocketing from obscurity to the front of the pack in 5 seconds.
Yes, and it's encouraging and a little scary. I mean, imagine if someone rocketed to the front right at the wrong moment and then got momentum and then went on, and it turned out the person was Herman Cain. I see a positive import here beyond what you were saying, Tom, but in line with it. You know, Herman Cain really was the vehicle of the Koch brothers. Let's face it, and the Koch brothers are ranked industrialists. They're ranked as the 10th leading polluter in the United States. They have clear interests in the government that really aren't aligned with that of most people who breathe the air.
And he was in the speaking circuit with them for some years, and
that's
close to
right.
them, you know, talks about them very warmly.
Very warmly. He spoke of Charles Koch as, quote, my brother by another mother. Mm. And his organization, the Koch organization, Americans for Prosperity, that was pretty much the Cain campaign. Well, you know, if Cain is the best the Koch brothers can do by way of a candidate, well, I think the fear that was stirred about them earlier in this year may not be so paramount. I mean, where is their judgment in picking a man whose knowledge of foreign policy really makes Sarah Palin look like George Kennan? These people, with all their money, with all their savvy, with all their organization, this is the guy they put out there.
Well, and yet people are sick of what's going on in Washington. They're looking for something different. There was one this week soaring in the polls, happy to say that maybe the savior has arrived. Newt Gingrich talking about Newt Gingrich here with Sean Hannity on Fox News. He was at Tommy's Country Ham House in Greenville, South Carolina, Wednesday night. And here's the former Speaker of the House talking about his personal change of fortune.
We may actually see a totally different dynamic than anybody could have predicted even a month ago, including me. Because a month ago, I didn't think we would get here for another 60 days. But it's clear the country's talking to itself. And it's clear that across the country, people are saying, you know, I think we need Newt Gingrich because we need somebody who can debate Obama. We need somebody who's actually done it before. We need somebody with very substantial, big ideas. And so I think, whereas I would have thought originally it was going to be Mitt and not Mitt, I think it may turn out to be Newt and not Newt.
Newt, all about Newt. Nancy Cordes, you've been with Newt Gingrich and his campaign just in the last
yes.
few days. I mean, we've got numbers now out of Florida showing him with 50 points in the polls there, way up above Romney, soaring down, and in other key states as well. Not New Hampshire yet, as far as I've seen. You know, some people can't believe this. He was sort of, you know, declared dead on arrival 10 years ago by the Republicans. But here he is. What do you think of Newt Gingrich right now?
Well, the one person who claims not to be surprised is Newt Gingrich,
of
who
course,
says
yeah.
He always expected to be in front. He didn't expect that he would be this far in front at this point. But when I spoke to him, he seemed extremely confident and laughed off all of those advisors who left him over the summer to go work for Rick Perry, who may now be regretting that decision, saying that he was always focused. He just has his own pace and he wanted to go at his own pace. And he feels very comfortable with where he is. And he, for the most part, is staying positive. He does manage to get in a dig at Mitt Romney once in a while, Michelle Bachmann once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
But he's you know, going out there and talking about his ideas. And in South Carolina, he got a very, very warm reception from people there all across the state.
Saying, you know, I may not be a perfect candidate, he said in South
right.
Carolina this week. I just claim to be a lot more conservative than Mitt Romney and a lot more electable than anybody else. Enrique is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Enrique, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having
yes.
me. I think that the unfortunate thing for Mitt Romney, I think he's a decent person and but, you know, he's part of that club, the private equity club. They made a lot of money making deals and shedding jobs from companies. And, you know, the people, I think, they just feel, first, they don't understand the industry, and second, they truly feel that the only way to get somebody up there that represents them is to have somebody that comes from a different background. And, you know, I was an investment banker, and I can tell you that the private equity industry, it is a kind of a club industry where, the bigger the deal, the more, you know, the bigger the commissions, and you know, you get the private deal flow. That's, you know, based on relationships.
Sure.
That's not based on, you know, a lot of competition.
Well, can be. I mean, that's really interesting, John Bussey. Here's Newt, Mitt Romney with his ads out saying, you know, a conservative businessman. I haven't been a politician all my life like Newt Gingrich, he said in the last few days. But Enrique's been in that business, and he says, you know, that actually could cut against Mitt Romney as well. What do you think, John?
Well, there's no question that right now in the country, there's this anti-business vibe. You're seeing it in the Occupy Wall Street movement, which just seems to continue to have traction, even though it seems a little bit ambiguous and kind of doesn't have an agenda.
Yeah, yeah.
It nonetheless has a remarkable amount of popular support. I've seen polls where about a third of people in the country support it.
But you've got now, so you many anti vibes. You've got an anti-business vibe there. You've got an anti-government vibe, an anti-Congress vibe. It's approval rating low as ever. President Obama's rate not so high. You've got antis all over the place, John.
Yeah, that's right. Now what Mitt is Romney's trying to do is say, look, with all this seizure in Washington, you can't get anything done. You can't get a deficit program. You can't get the Keystone Pipeline approved. You can't get payroll tax resolution. What you need is a manager, and I'm a manager. He's not saying I'm a businessman or a Wall Streeter. He's saying I'm a manager. I know how to come in and operate a big organization and make it work.
Well, here's Newt Gingrich stepping into that kind of vacuum now, if that's what it is. Cover of Time magazine this week, Mitt Romney and the big headline, Why Don't They Like Me? Of course, Newt has his own vulnerabilities. Ron Paul went after him very tough with a web ad on Wednesday, attacking Newt Gingrich as a quote-unquote serial hypocrite. The ad uses clips of reporters and Gingrich's own words and some sound distortion to paint him, Gingrich, as a flip-flopper.
Everything that Gingrich railed against when he was in the House, he went the other way when he got paid to go the other way.
You're an embarrassment to our party.
He's flipped and flopped based on who's paying him.
He's demonstrating himself to be the very essence of the Washington insiders.
It's about serial hypocrisy.
So says Ron Paul, serial hypocrisy. We'll see where that goes. Linda, Millis, Massachusetts. Linda, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi.
In the 90s, I lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and had an opportunity to go to a town hall meeting to meet Newt while he was speaker.
Okay.
And I was standing in line to get to the microphone, and there was a gentleman standing in front of me who was obviously very poor, and he had a severely disabled son in a wheelchair. And he gets to the microphone, and he tells Newt, I need help. My son's Social Security disability was cut by $5 a week. I need help. The crowd booed him, and Newt let the crowd do that. Newt didn't tell the crowd to be quiet. He didn't tell the crowd to show the man respect. Newt didn't even offer any kind of compassion. He didn't say, oh, my aide will talk to you. I'm sorry to hear about it. It was just an utter and complete lack of compassion for this very poor man. And I was appalled.
Well, Linda, I appreciate your calling with that. I mean, Nancy, what about this? You know, he can be very cutting. He can be mean. Mm-hmm. He can also be very grand. And he can come across as an iconoclastic, but, unbounded thinker. And some are very hungry for that right now. What about the balance with this guy? Or is there balance?
I think there is balance. I mean, I think just this week you heard him say that poor children don't have a work ethic. He definitely is not afraid to throw out a very politically incorrect line, although there are people who eat that up and applaud it.
Well, and in fairness, you could look at the unemployment rate in a lot of poor neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. There are not a lot of jobs for kids there. He doesn't put it sweetly. But if, kids are looking for jobs, there are not jobs. He says, let them be janitors in the schools. I don't know if that's the way to go, but some people may interpret that as candor.
Right. And he's very comfortable with that. I mean, that is part of his brand. He has been going around this week calling President Obama a radical socialist who was never properly vetted, who believes in some weird European strange worldview. So he's not going to hold back. That's not Newt Gingrich.
Never properly vetted. Are we back to that? Oh, boy. Here we go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Syracuse assistant basketball coach Bernie Fine was fired Sunday after three men accused him of childhood sex abuse. In this 2002 tape provided to ESPN by one of Fine's accusers, Bobby Davis, Davis asks Bernie Fine's wife if he was the only victim. She says, no, I think that there might have been others.
Do you think I'm the only one I've ever done that to?
No. I think that there might have been others. Well, what did he want you to do? You can be honest with me.
He was like, when first he grabbed me and, touching me.
He'd grab me and start touching me. In Connecticut, three well-heeled money managers win a $254 million lottery jackpot. Or did they? Some say it's all a front for an even richer anonymous winner.
Those subdued expressions on the faces of the three lucky winners raises questions. Why aren't these guys more excited?
What most people would be, and Grammy nominations are out. Kanye West leads the pack with seven, including one for Song of the Year with his All of the Lights.
Top lights, flashlights, spotlights, strobe lights, street lights, all of the lights, all of the lights.
We're looking at a week in the news, payroll tax debate, dollars for Europe, Kane in trouble. You can join the conversation. What do you see? It's top story this week. What's your word on Barney Frank, on World AIDS, Bono, and those rich guys and their lottery ticket in Greenwich, Connecticut? Nancy Cordes is with us from CBS, John Bussey from The Wall Street Journal, Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Orlando, Florida, and David. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Who's going to be the bad guy of all the Republicans out there? Who has the history of being the bad guys willing to stand up and say, enough, cut spending? President Obama's not going to do it. Congress isn't going to do it. Senate isn't going to do it. Some individual like Newt is going to do it. Like him or not, he has the guts to do it.
And it sounds like, David, you're ready for that. You say, bring that on.
Bring it on. I don't want to go like Europe. Europe is going to stay in this mess until one bad guy gets up there and says, cut, cut, cut. That's what you have to do. Do it, and Newt's going to do it.
Yeah, well, in the 90s, of course, a lot of things did get cut. Bill Clinton worked with him on that. Jack Beatty, what do you say? Bring on the bad guy. You know that impulse. It's going to take a tough, maybe unpopular guy to do this.
Well, he certainly has a reputation for being the bad guy, and you're right, Tom. He can take pride in having participated with Clinton in really our first solvency in 40 years in achieving that. But any view of his about cutting the budget is almost invariably, I don't know what the numbers would look like, but my guess would be way offset by his tax cut plans. He's got all kinds of plans to cut taxes, which would have the same effect as the spending, that is, increasing the deficit. I don't really know how he stands on a constitutional amendment, but that to balance the budget, but that's just a gimmick. The truth is the Republican Party isn't really so serious about deficit reduction. In the final analysis, they want tax cuts first, deficit reduction second, if at all. And I think that applies to Gingrich.
Nancy, do you buy that? Not so serious about deficit reduction. They took us seriously into a difficult place last summer saying, you know, on the whole budget, we're just not going to budge until we bring this down.
I do think that tax cuts are a larger priority for them than deficit reduction. I think that it's not to say that they don't care about deficit reduction, but I think they're just not willing to do it at the expense of tax increases. But I want to say that David's comment, I think, crystallizes why Gingrich is spiking in the polls and why he may not be a flash in the pan like some of the other contenders. When I was in South Carolina, voter after voter on the Republican side said to me, we want someone who can bring the fight to President Obama. And they're worried that Mitt Romney can't do it because some of his positions in the past have lined up with President Obama, because they're worried that the president can simply say, Mitt, I don't know where you stand on all these issues. You're inconsistent, and sort of knock him out. What they like about Gingrich is that he is not afraid to go there and to fight dirty if he has to with the president. They want to see a tough fight in 2012.
John Bussey, you're there in New York, executive business editor at the Wall Street Journal. How about the argument that tax cuts are the way to fix what ails this country? In the world you and your reporters move, in the business world, let's say, does that still pass muster? Does that cut ice? Or are people looking at the whole deficit and saying, let's get the whole thing? Or are they saying, no, let's roll out more stimulus and get some jobs going here?
Yeah, the business community is really clear about what they the reason they're sitting on all that cash that you referred to earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is they say, you know, we don't have clarity on any of the things you just described. So we don't know where the tax code is going. And yes, we do want lower taxes for companies in the United States because countries abroad have lower taxes. It pays me more to start the plant, to put the job overseas, more so than in the U.S., and it shouldn't. So the U.S. needs to make its tax code competitive with other nations. But I don't know where my health care costs are going, because that isn't resolved. I don't know where the deficit is going, and that matters to me because I'm in the business of selling to the government. So is government procurement going to be down or up? I don't know any of these things. So what am I going to do? I'm going to do what the average consumer is doing. I'm going to sit on my cash. I'm not going to spend. I'm not going to invest.
Well, it makes 2012 all the bigger. Marcia in Iowa City, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Marcia. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to make a few comments about the Republican candidates, Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich.
Okay.
Herman Cain is a buffoon. He doesn't have intellect. He has a serious moral problems. Anybody that doesn't believe these women is not paying attention to reality. I wouldn't want this man to represent me for anything.
You call him a buffoon, but a lot of Republicans have put their hand up and said, I like his message. That's my guy in polls.
Well, a lot of Republicans are cheating rich white men, too.
Well, oh, geez. Okay. It takes all kinds all over. What about Newt, you said, Marcia? What about Mr. Gingrich?
About Newt Gingrich, he is a rich white man. He has no clue that $30 or $40 does indeed make a difference to a family every month.
He certainly got a lot richer in these last years since he left the speakership with his big, he says it's not lobbying, but a lot like lobbying work in Washington. Millions from that. Marcia, appreciate your call. But maybe, as David in Orlando said, maybe he's the bad guy who will do the tough thing. Dennis in Omaha, Nebraska. Dennis, you're on.
I completely disagree with the caller who said the tough guy is going to win. And the reason is that the big winner of this GOP debate is really the Mormon Church, because only their candidates are allowed to act like responsible adults.
You're talking John Huntsman and Mitt Romney?
That's right. They're the only ones who have permission from their base to act like responsible adults. No one has the courage to say the word compassionate conservative anymore. They don't dare say that. I'm still a fan of George H.W. Bush because he taught me to be a compassionate conservative. I don't hear that from any of these people. And so the closest anyone comes to a rational, sane adult are the candidates who come from the Mormon Church. Us Protestants are made to look crazy, and the Catholics are left out.
I don't know about left out, but does Rick Santorum not very high in the polls? Well, Nancy Cordes, I mean, it is true at this point. I mean, if you want to look at it that way, Mitt Romney and John Huntsman, at least in their delivery, and Huntsman maybe more, do have the kind of sort of kinder, gentler delivery in this gang.
Right. You know, I've been chuckling this morning over a quote I read from Pastor Robert Jeffress in an article by Dave Weigel on Slate, where he said there's now an evangelical trilemma. Do you vote for a Mormon who's had one wife, a Catholic who's had three wives, or an evangelical, Herman Cain, who may have had an entire harem?
Oh, jeez. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Wow. We're out in sex land here. You know, while we've got this on the table, though, let's look at Mitt Romney for a second. With respect, Dennis, in Omaha, this issue has kept boiling this week of the Romney ad that came out, quoting Barack Obama, saying, you know, if we talk about the economy, we're going to lose. And it has become totally crystal clear that quote in the Romney ad was taken deliberately, I guess, completely out of context. Well, listen, here's the ad. Mitt Romney, his first TV ad for New Hampshire last week.
We need a rescue plan for the middle class. We need to provide relief for homeowners. It's going to take a new direction. If we keep talking about the economy, we're going to lose.
I'm going to do something to government. I call it the smaller, simpler, smarter approach to government. Getting rid of programs, turning programs back to states, and finally, making government itself more efficient.
Okay, maybe, but that quote from President Obama was taken 100% out of its context. It wasn't his words. It was President Obama quoting an aide to his rival, John McCain. Here's the actual statement, Londonderry, New Hampshire, October 16th, 2008, President Obama in full.
Even as you're worried about keeping your jobs or paying your bills or staying in your homes, my opponent's campaign announced earlier this month that they want to turn the page on the discussion of our economy so they can spend the final weeks of this election attacking me instead. Don't boo now, just vote. Senator McCain's campaign actually said, and I quote, "If we keep talking about the economy, we're going to lose."
Jack Beatty, what is going on when a contender for the White House takes that blatantly, falsely, you have to say, out of context, puts it right in the middle of an ad and acknowledges none of that fooling around with the facts?
Well, first of all, as Frank Bruni pointed out in the New York Times over the weekend, Senator Obama, then candidate Obama, was himself being deceptive. That wasn't a statement by the McCain campaign. That was an anonymous quote out of the McCain campaign, tantamount, really, to people quoting the anonymous quote to the New Yorker about the Obama foreign policy he leads from behind as somehow an official statement of the administration.
But, Jack, let's be careful, because he did say, we just heard it, the president, the candidate then, Senator McCain's campaign actually
yes.
said so.
Well, yes, but again,
okay, it was anonymous. Nevertheless, that's a lot closer to the truth than putting it in his mouth the way Mr. Romney did.
That's certainly true. And the cynical way the Romney people reacted to it said volumes. He did say the words, said one of his New Hampshire people, Romney's people. That's his voice. Wow. And how did the media report this? Very good writing about it in the Huffington Post. The New York Times wrote, "Democrats reacted ferociously to Mitt Romney's first campaign commercial, which they said distorted comments by Barack Obama." They said? And here's how Fact Check dealt with it. They called it it's a matter of opinion whether this was a distortion. This is essentially the media surrendering before a thunderingly obvious lie. And, let's just hope that's not going to be indicative, because some people think the Romney campaign was essentially testing the waters, seeing how low they could go without stirring a huge media backlash. And on the evidence, they haven't done that yet. So it wasn't a happy moment, I think, for the media.
Let's hope Americans insist on something a little more straightforward and honest than that. We've got an important campaign debate to have in front of us here. Nancy, we've got a comment here online I want to put to you. Here's TF says, "I'm accepting bets that Mitt's interview with Brett Baer on Fox was the toughest," and this was last week. He asked him about his flip-flopping. Romney got very shirty about it. He's accepting bets that's the toughest thing a Republican will sit for from Thanksgiving through Election Day. Soon, he writes online, "Roger Ailes will give the order from on high that Newt is political heir to Will Rogers and Jefferson Smith just because he's just that likable, honest, and outsidery." It is interesting, Nancy, the way you've got less in the way of public appearance and people standing in living rooms and much more of this GOP primary race on Fox, Roger Ailes country.
Right. And I think that what you saw this week was that really didn't do Mitt Romney many favors. And the fact that he has done so few interviews this election cycle really worked against him rather than for him. Because, maybe I'm in the minority. I didn't think that interview was that devastating. Mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, he was a little testy, but President Obama gets testy in
sure.
interviews. Newt Gingrich gets testy in interviews. The difference is they do interviews all the time. So sometimes they're testy, sometimes they're not. The overall impression is that, that they're honest brokers. When Mitt Romney doesn't do any interviews for months and then suddenly does one and gets testy, it makes it look like he's trying to hide something.
Can't complain when you get a tough question when you haven't been available for them all that time. Orlando, mm-hmm. Florida, Saeed is on the air. Saeed calling. Hi, Saeed. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Hi, guest.
Hi.
I just wanted to bring a different perspective, and I wanted to tie in three different events that took place this week, which
okay.
is the elections in Egypt,
yes.
the attack on the Pakistani soldiers, and then the storming of the UK embassy in Iran. And my perspective is just basically kind of responding to the responses of all those three events. For a while we've heard about the Egyptian elections that Americans should be careful of, of allowing the Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood to get involved and
right.
become the power, which I agree with. Their view is not something that I would agree with either. And then also, when you look at the responses from American politicians, it's, one of the congresswomen in Florida was like, well, we should tie in aid depending on whether or not the Muslim Brotherhood comes to power. If we were to react to other countries' concerns about how our politicians are and what our policies are and who comes to power, we would never take it. We would just tell them to back off
mm-hmm.
and don't get involved. And then as far as the attack on the Pakistani troops, I mean, here we have an ally, for good or for worse, we need them. Yet we weren't even willing to apologize to them. We kind of, let out some sympathies, but that was it. You know, they weren't asking for blood money or anything like that. Yet, you know, Obama didn't even try to apologize to try and make some real amends. And now who knows what the consequences of that will be.
Saeed, I appreciate your raising all three of those. Our time is so short. I want to take that straight to John Bussey, if I may. John, mainly because your newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, reporting today, and that was a very tough scene. 24 Pakistani soldiers killed by NATO fire, read U.S. in this case, across the border, Afghanistan, into Pakistan, but your news, and huge upset about that in Pakistan, but your paper is reporting that Pakistani officials at a border coordination center had given the go-ahead for American airstrikes that killed those Pakistani troops. What about it, John?
Yeah, this is the virtue of the Pentagon saying, look, we're not going to really say anything until we figure out what the heck happened. There was a center. A call was made, we need to bomb because we're getting fired on. Are there any of your troops in the zone? And word came back, according to the Pentagon now, no troops in the zone. And so the bombing
took Pakistani place. Troops in the zone. Nope, go ahead and fire.
That's right. So there's going to be a big debate over this. Now, there have been extensive condolences extended to Pakistan. I think what they want is
just not the president apologizing.
That's right. A public statement from the president. And that's not been forthcoming. And I think that maybe we're seeing now why that was the case.
But, Jack, we do have this picture that Saeed points out, elections in Egypt and people worried about the Muslim Brotherhood. But here we are. We're in a new season. People are voting. That's what we're asking for. They're going to have their, if they're honest elections, they're going to have their way, their will.
And in Morocco, in Tunisia, probably soon in Libya, they're going to be voting and voting in a more Islamic direction. That is democracy. For years, people warned that would happen if the dictators kept the lid on. They kept the lid on. It's happening.
Well, you guys are all terrific. And Gal, Nancy Cordes, it's great to have you with us this week. We're so grateful for your time and insights. Nancy Cordes with CBS News. Thank you so much for being with us today, Nancy.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
John Bussey, your first time here. You're terrific. I hope you'll come back. Executive Business Editor at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining us today, John.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Jack, great to have you as always, my friend. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you too. And thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.